We'd like to thank Brent for those great comments and very helpful information for all of us. And anyway, appreciate those very much. I'd like to introduce our next speaker, and this is Dr. Kirtley Parker Jones. She is going to be speaking on the seven domains of women's health, and she is a professor emerita in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Utah, where she has had an academic appointment for the past 33 years. Her undergraduate degree was in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology from the University of Colorado, where she also attended medical school. Jones completed her residency in obstetrics and gynecology and her fellowship in reproductive endocrinology at Brigham and Women's Hospital of Harvard Medical School. Jones's clinical and research interests include contraception and family planning, advanced reproductive technology, and menopause. She's been a member of the National Medical Committee for Planned Parenthood and is a past chairman of the Association of Reproductive Health Professionals. She has taught ethics in reproductive medicine in the honors program at the University of Utah, as well as teaching reproductive medicine to medical students, residents, and physicians. She was awarded the Linda K. Amos Award for Distinguished Service in Women by the University of Utah and the Jarko Distinguished Teaching Award by the University of Utah Medical School of Medicine. In 2013, she was awarded the Calvin S. and Janelle N. Hatch Prize in Excellence in Teaching by the University of Utah. She has been involved in the administration of her department, medical school, and university, and has a certificate in alternative dispute resolution from the University of Utah. She is a past president of the Academic Senate at the University of Utah. She shares her life and interest in the environment and the health of the planet with her husband and partner of 40 years, Chris Jones. With that, we'd like to welcome Sister Kirtley Parker Jones, or Dr. Kirtley Parker Jones. Thank you.
No problem. Well, brothers and sisters, here I am. For those of you who don't bleed red, for those of you who bleed blue, you can see I've spent really my adult career at the University of Utah. When Dr. Hartman, Al, a good friend, asked me to give an after-dinner talk, I thought he was going to ask me to talk about either hormones or sex and hormones. But that's already been covered, kind of, with our first talk in terms of important things. So I'm actually going to talk about some things that I've learned from my patients. So I'm an educator, but every clinical encounter that I've had with women has left me more impressed at the way women think about their health and their lives. I'm going to just start off with a little example. When I ask men if they have belly pain, where they hurt, they go. And if I ask women where they hurt, they go like that. If you ask men about their history regarding a broken arm or something, they give you a very specific history. In general, when I ask women, they say, well, you know, I think I have found this lump in my breast, but it was shortly after the wedding, that my daughter's wedding, but it was really hot that year, and I wore a t-shirt maybe too long. And so women tend to be lumpers. They integrate the aspects of their life into their health. So I'm going to talk about the seven domains of women's health. And it's really a project of the University of Utah Center of Excellence in Women's Health, which is a national center of excellence in women's health. And we have a website, so you could go to Center of Excellence, Women's Health, University of Utah, and we have the seven domains there, and people can seek help if they are having difficulties in one of the domains. So women have told us, when you take care of women, that they're only as happy as their least happy child, or that they're really not feeling well if they're stressed. In fact, women can have big ovarian tumors, they can have cancer, and they say, doctor, do you think stress caused this? So women integrate their psychological, their social, their emotional, their intellectual, their environmental, financial, and spiritual health into their whole health. So it doesn't matter how old you are, for women. Now, men actually, I think, do this more than we give them credit for. But it becomes particularly important as women age because many aspects of their physical health are really tied in tightly with those other parts of their life. So the physical part, you guys, I don't need to tell you anything about their physical health. You know your physicians or your physician's spouses or partners that physical health is important, and you know how to measure physical health. And the government tells us we measure physical health by getting blood pressures and giving vaccines and pap smears. So that's clearly important, but it's only a segment of women's overall health. We tell people that they need exercise and they need good food, and I think women get this pretty well, and you get this. You know what a healthy diet is, mostly, and you know what physical activity, you probably write prescriptions for physical activity. But in fact, when I led a women's midlife clinic, when women came in, what was their number one concerns? Well, their concerns were, in midlife, there was about their memory, it was about menopause, it was about their heart health, only a little bit, because women don't think they're going to get heart disease. That's a guy's thing. Women trust their hearts to not betray them. So they don't always think about heart disease, even though it's the number one killer of women. And by 70, actually by mid-60s, women have more coronary artery disease than men. And I don't think women know that, but it's true. They're worried about their coping skills as they age. They're worried about cancer. And in fact, lifestyle and stressors and environmental health and environmental stressors all actually become risk factors for cancer, depression, memory problems, heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, and diabetes. So when we talk about the seven domains of women's health, it turns out that your spiritual health has a lot of positive effect if you have a good spiritual life, a healthy spiritual life. It actually affects whether you're insulin resistant, and it affects your blood pressure and your heart disease. So women, I think, have got the right idea and that their life is an integrated whole, because many of the things that are in the seven domains affect the big health problems for women. So I just mentioned that by the time, once again, this is hard for those of you far away, but you can see that cancer is in the little gray bar, and cancer is more common than heart disease in women up until, you know, in the mid to 60s and 70s, and then heart disease really takes off. Women are different in the way they present with heart disease than men. Their coronary arteries are a little smaller. They tend to have more microvascular disease. They tend to have more circumferential disease in their arteries than big clogs, so it isn't often picked up particularly well on angiography. So for women, the number one symptom of heart disease is fatigue. But if you ask women, if they're 50-year-old women, if they're tired, they say, yeah, I'm tired. And so fatigue is so vague, it's really not helpful. So women do present a little differently with heart disease. Well, social health, women are their health is tied up with their friends. And we actually talked a whole lot about marital health. BYU just published some very interesting data, which was alluded to, is that it's not being married that makes you live longer. It's being in a good marriage that makes you live longer. Being in a snarky marriage does not make you live longer. In fact, they had people who were assessing their moods and the quality of their relationship all day long, carry a little iPod thingy that they registered, and they walked around having their blood pressure checked about 40 times a day. And they found, sure enough, that when you're being snarky, you know, your blood pressure goes up. So it's a good marriage. It's good relationships, but women are pretty good, usually, at making good relationships with their girlfriends. So it's good friends, good relationships, and good marriages that make you live longer. Holding hands. If they put people in a PET scan and a functional MRI, and they had someone they trusted, either a spouse or a friend, hold their hand while they were in the fMRI, and all of a sudden their blood pressure went down, and their parts of their brain that are associated with relaxation became more active, and their pain scores went down. So having someone to give you a physical touch, a good friend, or your spouse, all these part of community and social relationships are really important to women. You guys know that. Well, it's important to be your own best friend. So it was great to hear the fact that, in fact, we can't ask our spouses to make us happy. It's our own responsibility to make ourselves happy. But we do have, sometimes as women, we always look care of everybody else and we don't always take care of ourselves very well. But I think we do need to balance our relationships with our sense of taking care of ourselves and taking care of our work. And sometimes women do so much for their family and their friends that they don't take care of themselves. But I ask women who are coming to see me for whatever problem, I ask, where are your most nurturing relationships? How do you feel your balance is with respect to your taking care of yourself versus taking care of your relationships? And I think this is important when you ask and when you take care of women, asking them about where their strengths come in their social relationships, because it really matters, and there's a lot of data to support that. I think women are great at mentoring, and often there's good data to suggest that women who are mentors and men who are mentors live longer. So being able to do things for others and younger others is something women do particularly well, and it makes them live longer. It makes their blood pressure lower. It also decreases the rates of cancer. So there are a number of things that are associated with social relationships which are really good. And this is my first time to use one of these cool little thingies, but I'm not sure it's just for me here. Well, I think it's important to lead a purposeful life, and this is part of both your social responsibility and your personal responsibility. But people who thrive in their 50s usually will say, I'm doing something that I feel is important for me, my family, and my planet. So the emotional health, I think, is also how women deal with stresses in their family ends up being very important in terms of their blood pressure, heart disease, and in fact, the Women's Health Initiative, that big study that looked at hormone replacement therapy, looked at women at the beginning of the 5 years and assessed them for their cynicism score and their negativity score. And then looked at people about 5 and 10 years later, and women who ranked high, these were women who started at the same level of health as their peers, but they ranked high in cynicism and negativity, had more heart disease and more cancer after 10 years than women who were generally optimists. Now, I can't ask people to fake it, but as you already heard, cynicism is deadly. It's deadly to your marriage, but it's also deadly to your immune system and your cardiovascular business. This particular image for me, when I was working 80 hours a week and I had a kid and a husband that I thought I was trying to take care of, and I felt like I was being sucked dry. And then I realized that the very parts of that syringe that sucked the blood out of me was also the syringe that put everything in me. So how you frame your relationships and what they do for you emotionally is important. If you see yourself being sucked dry by your relationships, then you will be. If you see those relationships as what really gives you your life's blood, that positive framing is more likely to make women feel better, make their blood pressure better. And when people feel better, it turns out that it actually improves insulin resistance. So this is something women have been telling us for many years, that all these things are important in their health, and it really is. The big bad five are unchecked worry and anxiety, chronic struggles with depression, unchecked anger, hostility, or cynicism, isolation and loneliness, and chronic marriage or family tensions. You guys had a wonderful talk just before me about how these things are really bad for your relationship, but they're also really bad for yourself. So I don't know whether Christine Zelenkov is here, but I'm giving you this Venn diagram, which is what I actually circle on the sheet. So I'm a gynecologist, so there's always a table, and it's covered with some paper, and I take my pen, and I draw this for my patients. The one is the big circle are the things that you can control, which includes a lot of stuff that doesn't matter, like whether you do the dishes or not. On the other circle are things that matter. Now, a lot of things that really matter you can't control. But where you put your energy is where the things that really matter and where you can control them, that's where you put your energy. You don't spend a lot of energy on things you control that don't matter, like dishes. And you don't spend a lot of time controlling things that don't matter. It's that middle intersection. And I think that's a tool that women can use, and men, in terms of deciding where you're going to put your emotional energy. Well, it turns out that your intellectual health is important. Education is a good marker for longevity. People who are well-educated have less cancer, and they have less heart disease. But the educational process doesn't stop, and you already know that because you're all here, so I don't need to tell you. But I see people doing things, let's say like they do crossword puzzles because it's going to help them keep their brain healthy. Well, doing crossword puzzles helps you be better at doing crossword puzzles. In fact, it's doing kind of novel things and doing new things and learning new things that seem to make the brain age the best. We're all born with our general proclivity to developing dementia and Alzheimer's, but there's some good data regarding both activities, the environment you live in, your exercise and diet, but also how much you exercise your brain. So education is a powerful predictor of better health. So there's exercise is good. Women who exercise regularly have better cognitive scores. Prescribing exercise is hard because people don't want to do it, and it's very hard to get a placebo-controlled trial. So it's hard to tell people they're exercising when they're really not. It does decrease stress and psychological distress. So exercise's role in improving memory may be because it decreases stress, and chronic stress directly affects the hippocampus. You can show people who've been under chronic stress for a long time, their hippocampus gets smaller on fMRI. So doing things that can decrease stress and exercise is a good one. Diet for cognition. Well, we're told that antioxidants and phytochemicals and blueberries and all those things are good, but you can't take a vitamin because they've given vitamins and it doesn't seem to make a difference. You have to eat the food. So whether it's the blue and the blueberries or whether it's something else, I don't know, but you can't take the vitamin. So I talked about cognition and stress. There's a positive aging strike for functional maintenance. So if you feel like you're losing your memory, don't have to remember everything. Eliminate what you don't really need to remember. Practice what you want to get better at doing. And compensate, and I think the yellow sticky is the best compensatory mechanism I can think of in terms of helping me with my memory. When I was a busy clinician, and I would phone somebody, and they would put me on hold, and then 5 minutes would go by and I couldn't remember who was on the phone, so I always had a little sticky on the phone that reminded me who was on the phone while I was trying to do several things at once. So the yellow sticky is a great compensatory if you feel like your cognitive function isn't at the level that you'd like. I don't think I'm going to spend a lot of time on mnemonics, remembering a name, but I want to go on to environmental health because there's pretty good evidence that the environment, the inside environment and the outside environment affects both women's fertility and their sense of well-being, but that includes the air you breathe, your hormone, your house environment, even what you put on your skin. So I think that healthy homes, people who are asthmatic who live in homes that have a fair amount of dust or other kinds of airborne chemicals certainly can have a more difficult time, but you can develop secondary asthma by living in not so very healthy homes. So I think it's important to decide where you're going to fight your health battles. I'm a firm believer in avoiding canned foods and beverages, at least for people who want to ever have babies, because all cans, pretty much most cans, are lined with BPA, which is an estrogenic compound. It was actually used as an estrogen in the 30s. So when you drink a Diet Coke, you're actually getting this tiny, tiny little shot of a molecule that actually binds to the estrogen receptor. It's been associated with, some people think it's an obesogen, it makes people fat. So I think I'm pretty careful about not feeding myself, but definitely not feeding my son and his wife things that come out of cans lined with BPA. I pretty much try to stay away from some plastics, and I don't microwave in plastic any food. I think we have lots of good data for that. I try to avoid pesticides in homes and lawns. I think we have this tragic effect tragic story of in Clearfield of two little kids that died because of a pesticide that the parents were using to try to decrease the number of voles in their lawn, and the dose was wrong. I think you need to be careful when you're deciding to use pesticides or herbicides. It's up to you. You get to make the decisions about what things you're going to put in your environment. But I wash my fruits and vegetables. I buy organic when it matters. I think that's kind of up to you. I think it's particularly important for young people. So as now that I'm 65, I think that my burden of cancer-producing chemicals has been accumulated at this point. I don't say that it's not worth trying, but I'm much more concerned for the children who come into my house and my son and my daughter. Well, it turns out that if you're thinking about your environment, what you put on your skin matters. So anything you smell goes immediately. If it goes to your brain, then it's also going to your heart. And if you're pregnant, it goes to your baby. So many of the things that are in cosmetics actually are quickly accumulated into your bloodstream. If you're pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, you may want to go to the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics. You may not be able to read this, but if you just Google the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics or Cosmetics Database, you can plug in whatever cosmetics, lotions, shampoos, toothpaste that you want and get an assessment as to whether this particular set of chemicals is good for children, good for pregnant women, good for adolescent males who are trying to make sperm someday. So you can actually try to be a little healthier by what you put on your skin. They will give you a score of 1 to 10, and 1 to 6 or 1 to 4 is actually pretty good. And if it's over a 6 in terms of risks, you may decide why you really have to put that on your skin. Guys don't have to worry because they don't use that much product. You know, they're good. They don't put that much on their skin. But women put a lot of stuff on their skin. If you look in your purse and you pull out your moisturizer and you look at what's in it, if they label it, if you can't pronounce a lot of those things, then my guess is you may want to Google this database. I think we all are pretty smart about lead in terms of healthy environments. We've been pretty good about that, although I don't know that we all know how much lead is still in the pipes of our old homes. We've all actually been reading about what happened in Flint with the pipes that had a fair amount of lead in them that leached out when they started putting more acids in the water. But mostly I think we need to make sure that our homes are healthy, so our healthy environment. Indoor air quality, if you want to make your particulate matter in your home go up dramatically, all you need to do is fry something on the top burner or stand right next to a barbecue, and all of a sudden you've got particulate matter that you're breathing that's worse than Beijing. Now, luckily, you're only doing it for 10 or 15 minutes and not all day. But I think there are ways to look at how to keep your air healthier. And why do I care? Many of you are from the north end of the valley, north end of the Wasatch Front. But for those of you who are from the south end, you may remember what Geneva Steel looked like in the 80s. Anybody remember driving through Utah Valley during the 80s when Geneva Steel was active? Well, it turns out that Geneva Steel went on strike in the mid-80s. These are the rates of prematurity. Now, Utah Valley should have the lowest rates of prematurity in the country. Women are healthy, they're white, they're Paris, they've had babies, they don't smoke, they don't drink, they have all the kinds of behaviors that would make for very low rates of prematurity. When Geneva Steel was opened, the rates of prematurity in Utah Valley were the same as the population in the entire United States. When Geneva Steel was closed, the rate of prematurity went down a couple percent, went down by 50%, but it went down from about 6% to about 4%, so that was about a 50% reduction. And then when they opened back up, it went right back up. We've got lots of data that says that air quality affects fetuses and affects growth of children and asthma and women, but I think this was the experiment that really put air quality problems on the map. And because we live in the Wasatch Front, air quality is a big one for us. Well, financial health, Luckily for most of you, you're mostly going to be financially okay. But I'll have to say I was awestruck after taking care of women for almost 40 years, how many women didn't know what their financial status was because their husband took care of that. Well, they took care of that until they left. And then women really had no idea what they had that they could retire on or how they could take care of their kids. So when women are financially stressed in your practice, when they come to you, they don't feel good. I asked women who are coming to me for whatever, you know, I ask if the home is a safe place. I ask how their relationships are going. I ask if they're financially healthy enough. Are they financially secure? Now, I'm not a finance person, but I know where they can get help. So women who hold assets and gain incomes, their families are more likely to have kids. They're more likely to spend money on nutrition, medicine, and housing. Now, this is worldwide, maybe not here in Utah, but around the world, when women have money, their children do better. So when women have money, their whole households do better. So women should have some resources on their own and that they can actually count on. I tell women they should, if they're worried about their resources, they should keep a spending log. They should know where their money is going. They should try to get some assets, if they can, in reserve. And there are financial counselors that can help them do that. The YWCA has financial counselors that can help people with budgets if people are running on the low side of financial resources. Now, that's not us so much. That's one of the great things about the jobs that we do. But women who are at the edges of finances have more prematurity. Low-income women have more prematurity. Low-income women have more heart disease. Low-income women have more cancers. Well, let's go past retirement. And I want to talk at my final little bit, is the last little wedge, is on spiritual health. Over and over and over, even though in the 70s we thought spiritual health as a part of medicine was kind of a woo-woo thing, we now know that people have a strong sense of spirituality. Actually, their blood pressure is lower, they have less heart disease, they have less cancer. But more importantly, when those things do become part of their life, they are more resilient. So we know that spirituality is something that sometimes it's hard to talk about in the clinic. It's often hard for us to put words to it. One of the great advantages of a structured religion or faith is it helps us give words to our spirituality. But many people feel very spiritual without having a specific religion. We know that our relationships are important. We know that love, not erotic love, not infatuation love, but agapic love, filial love, the love of our children, the love of our friends and family, is very important, and it helps ground us. Feeling love for your family is something that really helps people be stronger, and it's a spiritual kind of love. We know that grace, spirituality, helps us live in a sense state of grace. Now, whether it's God's grace, you know what grace is. When someone comes in and they're full of grace, or they grace the room with their presence, it's hard to know exactly how to define it. But people who have a strong sense of spirituality, whether it's in a functional religion or whether it's something that they have their own definition, they come into the room and they make the room a better place. We know that many people go to their sense of spirituality for serenity. In the face of the winds of bad health, bad economy, a really ugly presidential election, there is time when we need to look for some place where we can find some calm. And when we have a spiritual foundation, it gives us a chance to have serenity. Because what we're really looking for is resilience. And it turns out that women, no matter what illnesses they have, if they are resilient, and their resilience comes from their spirituality, their sense of being able to cope, their sense of purpose, then they actually do much better. And you've all seen patients in your practices. You have 10 people with back pain, and some people seem to be doing perfectly well, and some people will never work again. What are the differences between those people? Well, I'm not an alcoholic, but I actually carry around with me the Serenity Prayer, which is the verbal recognition of the Venn diagram that I showed you, which is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I can't change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So how one gets to that level of self-awareness, feeling part of something bigger than yourself, feeling connected with the others, that is very important for helping people in their overall health. Now, how do we incorporate spirituality in our medical practice? It turns out that about 87%, 97% of women have say that they are spiritual. They may believe in a God, or they believe in a higher power, or they believe in a force, or they have an organized faith. And it's important to them. About 65% of physicians say that they have that sense of belonging to a spiritual entity or being spiritual people. However, physicians say that they believe it's important for their patients. However, only 11% of physicians actually ask their patients about their spiritual needs in their spiritual life, and that's because they don't have time. So the American Academy of Family Physicians suggested you might use the HOPE paradigm, and it takes a minute or two, but it does two important things. It teaches you some things about the patients, men and women, but I'm thinking about women in particular, but it teaches you some things about them, and it gives you some resources if they're having a hard time to know what they think is important. But more importantly, you become a three-dimensional clinician. So it's important when patients know that you care about the things that are fundamentally important to them, they then become more willing to engage in a therapeutic relationship with you. They're more likely to listen to you when you're making suggestions about their health. So the HOPE paradigm, this is from the American Association of Family Practice, and they have, if you go to AAFP.org, they have a lot of material including a handout that you can give patients so that they can learn about how they can express to their physician the importance of their spiritual life if they have one. So the H is, what are your sources of hope? Do you have, what are your sources when things are hard for you? What are your sources of spiritual and emotional calm? Where do you get your strength and your comfort from? Many women will say, my family, and that's good, that's great. But some people, women will actually open up a little bit more and they'll say, I have a strong sense of my spirituality and that I belong to something bigger than myself. Do you belong to an organized faith or religion? That's important for you to know if someone's coming in the hospital, or someone's very sick. It's important that they get the kind of spiritual help that is most familiar for them. So sending one kind of spiritual advisor to their room when they really don't feel like that's not in their voice. My sister-in-law was being operated on for ovarian cancer, a big tumor, which turned out not to be cancer, but at the time she was pretty sure. And they asked her if she wanted to see the Catholic chaplain, and she's a non-denominational Jew, and she said, no, I don't want to see the Catholic chaplain. And it was an interaction that she didn't need to have if someone had really asked her where she was, if she had a faith, what kind of spiritual advisor she'd like to see, if anything. Do you have a personal spirituality or practice? And how can I not get in the way of that as your physician? And does your spiritual practice or your spiritual life or religion tell me anything about your medical care and end of life? So for some people, their spiritual pathways will be very informative in terms of the things they do and don't want at the end of life. So these can take just a minute to ask people. They will help you learn about your patients a little better. They will see you as a three-dimensional person who cares about them. And I think you'll get a lot farther with your patients or your spouses or your friends if you actually can use some of these techniques. So this guy, Cornelius Celsus, who was a physician in the first century AD, said that you should live in rooms full of light. You should avoid heavy food. Tonight's dinner was not heavy. I thank you for the Brussels sprouts. I'm a fan. Be moderate in the drinking of wine. Take massage baths, exercise and gymnastics. Change your surroundings and take long journeys. So thanks everybody who's here tonight from out of town. Strictly avoid frightening ideas. So that means try to not spend too much time on Fox or CNN if you can avoid it. Indulge in cheerful conversation, so I'm hoping you're having a great time talking to your friends at the table and amusements and listen to music. So a long time ago, this was the recipe for a long life. And these are many of the things we already say. You know, it turns out that sunshine is good for your brain, even if it's not good for your skin. Heavy food is not so good for you. Drinking too much is bad. Drinking a little isn't so bad for you, actually, by the way. Exercise is good. Friends are good. And stay away from scary stuff. So the seven domains of health are how women have told us they integrate their lives in their sense of their well-being. I'll tell you, I think that many men would aspire to the same thing, but I, having spent 40 years listening to women say, well, I think these are the things that I ask women, just a one little sentence in these domains is home a safe place. Tell me about your emotional life. What's happening with your social interactions, or where do you get your social strength from? How is your home in terms of being environmentally safe? Are you struggling with the bad air? Do you have enough money to make it through? Do you have financial concerns? How's your brain working? Are you worried about that? And tell me about the source of your spiritual wellness. And then I've learned a lot more about a person and a lot more about how she's going to cope with whatever health things I'm dealing with. So I want to say thank you. I know it's late for everybody who came and had dinner. I was thrilled to follow a brilliant presentation about marriages and relationships. All those things are very important to sense of wellness. And I hope you have a really great time in the next 4 days with a lot to learn. And thank you, Al, for inviting me. I don't know if anybody, does anybody have questions?